And then you got high tech Dimmy there.
Yeah, pumping
out the gigabytes.
Yeah. And also, like, lazy Jimmy doesn't want to go to the office, you know? It's like, that's probably the main reason, right?
Welcome to GCP Life, episode number 62, for Friday, the 12th of April, 2024. GCP Life is sponsored by Mantle Group. At Mantle Group, we make your Google Cloud solutions possible. And I am your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, it's a belated Easter. We look at some of our favorite Easter eggs, what's going on inside Google Cloud, and we have our usual roundup of new GCP features. Plus, we find out if a massive worldwide Linux security issue was just narrowly avoided. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dmitry Pokidov. How are you going, Dimmy?
Hey, Steve. Good, thanks. How are you doing?
Good, mate. Good. That was a mouthful, some of the intro in that one.
Yeah. It was a tricky one for sure.
I really got to make some of these sentences shorter in the intro. Otherwise, I'm stumbling over my words. But it'll be fine. It'll come out in the edit. How's your fortnight looked? What have you been up to?
Yeah, it's been good. Yeah, the greatest thing that happened, that my internet is back. So I got my NBN. So it took three attempts to fix it. It's been 4 days so far, and there was no drop offs, and there's definitely longer than before. So that's good. And yeah, the other was I was just preparing to my, this time, real adventure that I'm going on Monday. It's like a five days hike, my annual hike that I'm doing by myself. So yeah, it was just finding my backpack, started to buy things, and yeah, very excited about that one.
Nice. So because of that annual hike and the remoteness of the hike that you'll be in, we are recording a show a little bit earlier, a week earlier than usual. So we may be a little bit out of the news cycle, and there may be some stuff that we missed here, but doesn't matter. We'll get you some content anyway to take a listen to. And as for your internet, what did the fix end up being?
Yeah, well, there was a faulty equipment underground. That's an interesting one, because technician came like a first time, and he was like, our three units were out of the internet along with mine. And it seemed to be like he just plugged in the cables in and the internet just appeared. And then like next day there were drop-offs and all that usual stuff. Next time, the same technician came and said that this time it's not that box, it's a problem with my cables that running to the box, like just outside of one of the units. So yeah, he told me that I need to change all the cables. Well, the third time, when now the different technician came, he just went down there and said, the thing just died. So he put a new one. And
rip it out, replace it with a new one.
Yeah. Yeah. It just took me 3 months, I think. Yeah. And I'm probably 15 or maybe 20 cases. Like every time I would call and, you know, spend time on the call.
Yeah, excellent. That's sorted out for you. And it looks great, by the way. I mean, you must be getting some good gigabits coming through there at the moment. As for me, I've been working through some Apigee training, as I said on the last show. It takes a little while to get through this one. Normally, I blast through these skills, cloud skills boost training, but some of these concepts are new, and it does take a little while to provision some of these Apigee things. So you get caught up in the lab, and it's provisioning and spinning. But it's good. If you've not played with Apigee before, then you can go and do this. Do that. If you've got access to Cloud Skills Boost, you can go and do it. And I can see why it's becoming very popular and very easy to, very very well done. And like, I'm not going to say easy to use, but everything you need is there. It's high quality. Well, it's good engineering that Google's done with the Apigee API.
Yeah. I think that like that there's their next generation that IPGX looks really good. All the control plane and stuff, you don't need to run it inside your project, which is I think a really big step forward from IPGX Hub. Yeah. But much easier. So before, I thought like the big companies could definitely justify having IPG, whereas like a smaller ones could have just think once or twice, but I think it's like a no-brainer for like all companies of all sizes, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And outside of that, I have been playing with my VMware environment, and I managed to get NSX Team Manager running on the VMware environment, which is a little bit tricky. So this is good. So this will open up for me anyway the NSXT API, which means I can test Terraform stuff against my lab environment now in NSXT.
Nice. You mentioned last time, right, that there was a Terraform modules now available for GCVE. So is it?
There is, yeah. So you can actually spin up the entire environment now, the private cloud and the VMware components within your Google project. The cloud, VMware IAC Foundations, which is a Google managed set of modules, which I'm happy to say I put in a couple of pull requests for them.
I saw that. Yes. Congratulations. Yes. Oh, that's great. Yeah.
So I'm now officially a developer of the GCVE Terraform modules. So I'm going to continue to do that. There was some documentation that was out of whack, and I wanted a feature in there, so I put that in. And it's coming along quite nicely. Obviously, our goal with this is to have, you know, we want it some sort of solution accelerator, so when clients come to us, we can just turn the key and bang, everything stood up for them quickly as possible.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, really, really good. Very exciting stuff. Mm. All right, let's get on with the rest of the show. Hey, Dimmy?
Yeah.
Awesome. Good one. Let's get on with the community news.
Yeah, so next, Google Next is coming next week. That's a big one.
One big community event. And the thing is, we're recording a show now and we're recording a show after next. So completely missing it.
Well, the next show, probably could be like special, just covering all the news from the next.
Let's do that. Let's do a little wrap up of our favorite things from next.
That would be a good one. I think a few people, right, from Mental Group also went to Las Vegas to see it live, which is great.
You know, the last Next was only, feels like it was only just on. It was towards the end of last year, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think it feels like that because before there was no Next like for 3 years or so, right? Because of the COVID, all the lockdowns and stuff. Yeah.
Well, let's hope we don't get trolled by AWS on the big Sky Dome.
That's right. like Google did.
Let's see what stunt they pull off. Eh?
When I read the news, I was very surprised. Like how many things you need to, you know, think through. You need to even like buy all the advertised spaces around the building. I would never think about it.
No, that's right. I think they're making it a thing now. If you book out Las Vegas and that dome thing comes along with it.
All right.
Nice. To prevent that happening. Preemptive measure. Mm-hmm. All right, that's enough of the community news. OK, Okay, so Easter's just passed for us, and look, we probably should have done this as an Easter special, but we're going to do a belated Easter special. we thought we'd take a look at some of our favourite Easter eggs that have been getting around over the years. And Demi and I sat down during the fortnight, and we've come up with a list of things here. And then a little bit later, we'll take a look at how Google Cloud could help the Easter Bunny, because, you know, he's got a lot to do. So how could he help the Easter Bunny? But Demi, why don't you tell us about some of your favorite Easter eggs? You've got quite a list here.
I put together a list of three. Couple of them are the ones that I kind of like, uncovered and just read when it was like long time ago. The first one is in Vim, you can print command help 42. And of course, every time you hear 42, it should be somehow linked to the Hitchhiker's Guide. If you do that, the last paragraph would say, what is the meaning of life, the universe and everything? 42. Douglas Adams, the only person who knew what this question really was about, is now dead, unfortunately. So now you might wonder what the meaning of death is. from that you could probably gather that I'm a big Vim fan, and where I stay in the Vim versus Emacs holy war.
You're probably like me, Demi. As soon as you see some documentation that asks you to open Nano, that's the first thing you change.
Well, saying that, now I remember when I was trying Emacs, like, the one of the things that were there, they were like games inside Emacs, and like I was actually quite excited to saw those. The other one is a word Easter egg, the pinball game. That's something that there were like many Easter eggs right in the Microsoft. I know one of the things about the Windows or Microsoft Easter eggs, they were like such a crazy combinations to discover them. And so this pinball in Word 97, like you need to open a new document, type blue, select word, then go to format font, choose font style bold, color blue, type space, afterword blue, go to help about, control shift left click the word icon banner, use Z for left flipper, M for right flipper, and escape to exit. Discover what Microsoft means by productivity application. And there will be like a pinball game, open up. And I read about it probably in some magazine or something, but yeah, I was very, very excited when I could open it up. Not from the first time, of course, because there's like 10 steps.
Yeah, and because you're going to get it wrong the first time. You have to do it 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And the third one, I didn't know about that one, but I really liked the story, is about my favorite Go language. And about the wall clocks in a Go language. So one of the Yoshi Yamaguchi, it's his blog, and one of his friends noticed that the value for the minimum clock for the kind of time zero in Go lang is set to year 1885, and he was just asking the Yoshi, why could be that? And Yoshi said, it must be related to Back to the Future 3. That's where they went in that part. They thought that why would we guess? Let's just write the author of Go, Russ Cox. And so they sent an email. And Russ Cox replied and said, yes, it is actually the Back to the Future 3. Some interesting details around it is that you would think, why don't we just put it 1970, which is like a Unix zero time. But turns out that it's not. So it's kind of like epochs, and because Go needs to work like with everything, like there needs to be So that this time needs to be lower than like on any other systems. And if you look at what is NTP protocol, for NTP protocol says that time zero is 1900. And so you need something that lower than 1900, before 1900. And then, yeah, so 1885 was a choice of Rust and because of the Back to the Future 3. Also he mentioned in the email that before Go 1.8, there was another thing in the time package. There's a variable that called a long time ago, and which is needed. There is a comment there. It's a non-zero time far in the past used for immediate cancellation of network operations, and now it's set to just a one. So it's like a one millisecond. But before, it was set for something else. And if you look at this time and you translate this to the date time, it would be 25th of May 1977, which is, as you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. As I thought, it's pretty cool.
The date Star Wars was released, episode four.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I wonder why they changed it to one. they probably should go and have a look on the commit message on that one. Okay. Here you go, something to do after the show. what's your favorite?
Well, I did have the list of Microsoft products. Of course, they're famous for having Easter eggs in all of their Office suite. One of my favorite ones was Office 95, where Excel contained a hidden Doom-like minigame called the Hall of Tortured Souls, which is a series of rooms featuring the names and faces of the developers.
Oh,
It did generate some controversy where chain emails made spurious claims and conspiracy theories accusing Microsoft, particularly Bill Gates, of hiding satanic symbolism within its software. That was one of my favorites. That was kind of when I became aware of the idea and the concept of Easter eggs. Well, actually, no, not necessarily, because I actually had known of the concept of Easter eggs, but I didn't know that's what they were called, right?
Aye.
The reason I'd known about it is because I was a Commodore 64 user as a kid growing up, and most games on the Commodore 64, a lot of games, would have some sort of joystick fire button combination where you could unlock a secret mode or you could get extra lives or something like that. So I was a big fan of those, trying to figure those out. And of course, that's built over into the PlayStation later on, where you could press secret combinations of buttons and get some sort of code or extra lives or get some secret level. Super Mario Brothers did this. Mario Brothers did this famously as well, where you could go down certain parts of the level and pop out into another universe in different levels. But one of my favorite computer-related Easter eggs is a Christian rock band called Prodigal. In 1984, they hid a Commodore 64 program on a vinyl record. Now, how did they do this, right? So, if you were using computers in the early 80s, you probably would have used a data set, they call them. So, you put a tape in the data set and you play the data set and then it loads the binary into the computer. Now, on that data set, if you ever put that cassette tape into a normal cassette player, you would hear a bunch of squeaks and squeals and pops and clicks. And that is the binary file encoded into normal audio that could be recorded on a cassette tape. So between 0 and 20 hertz, if you were to compare it in today's language, it's equivalent to like about a 5 or a 6-bit WAV file. And you could record it in there, very slow bit rate, and you could put a file on there. Now, what this Christian rock group did is on the lead out on the vinyl record, they encoded that sound on the lead out. And if you have the right kind of record player and you put the stylus in the right spot, you can actually listen to that audio. I'll link a show in the show notes where someone went to the effort of recording that audio onto a cassette tape. They put that cassette tape into the data set on the Commodore 64 and it loads. It loads the program.
Unbelievable. I want...
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I wonder who found it.
And you would not know if you were to look at the lead out on the vinyl, unless you were eagle-eyed, it was right at the end. It's this tiny little strip and you would only... If you were used to looking at lead outs and you knew what they look like and then you noticed that this one, little tiny little strip, was a little bit different, that's the only way you could notice it, because if you had one of the more modern vinyl record players that had an auto return, what would happen? It would go into the lead out and then the stylus would lift up and automatically return. It would never get to the part that has the program encoded on it.
Oh.
Yeah. Really, really well hidden. And right there for everyone to see as well, which is the irony of it. But yeah, I love that Easter egg. Mm. Really cleverly done.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Yeah.
So we thought we'd also take a look at, just as a bit of fun one. Now, if you want to go back, I think it was May the 4th, 2023, we did how GCP could help the Empire and how GCP could help the Rebel Alliance, but we thought we'd do for an Easter special how GCP could help the Easter Bunny. Now, the Easter Bunny, right, he's hopping around everywhere. He's got a lot to do, right? He's got to take the orders from the mums and the dads and the kids, and then he's got to do the buying, right? He's got to buy all the stuff and he's got to put it in and he's got to go around and deliver it everywhere. So I thought, well, I mean, he could do with an app. We really could do with an app. How good would it be if you could just go on the app, make your order to the Easter Bunny, and bang, bang, your stuff shows up? So, first of all, you need an app, right? And you're going to put that in your Google Store, right? Of course, right? And you're going to run it on your Pixel phone. But then, I mean, I'm all about Apogee at the moment, so you're going to set up an Apogee API, aren't you? That's what you're going to do. And he could have puts and gets and have all his CRUD operations there in his API, and his app talks to the API, and then you've got to have somewhere to run all of this. Where are we going to run it, Dimmy? Oh. Kubernetes? Yeah. Let's run it on Kubernetes. Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Yeah, okay. You've got to have some workloads running on Kubernetes. And then I thought, he's global, right? He's big. He's going to have a lot of orders going on there. So he's got to put it in Spanner. It's got to be Spanner. He's got to have some zero latency, right? Low latency, global. It's got to be highly available because, that can't go down. If he loses those orders, I mean, there's going to be screaming kids everywhere. So he's got to put that into Spanner. I really think that architecture there is really what the Easter Bunny needs to fulfill his orders.
100%. It's multi-regional. Easter happens at the same time all over the world. Like, just you have only 24 hours to serve all the eggs. So yeah, that's what you need. Yeah, that's a really good example. I agree with this architecture, Steve. It's awesome.
Dimmy approved. Yeah. We'll get onto that. We'll get onto that for the Easter Bunny. But what did you think? What does the Easter Bunny need in your book?
Yeah, that's interesting because when we came up with that idea, and the first thing I was like, oh, what Bunny is doing? And I was like, oh, Bunny is just jumping all the time. And then for whatever reason, like, the first thing that appeared in my brain was like a quantum leap. And the Quantum Leap is like a TV show that I watched when I was a kid, like a long time ago.
Early 90s,
I actually had a look and it was only 4 seasons. And it seems to be like it wasn't like that popular, but...
It wasn't the best show, no.
my best friend and myself, we were like watching like every episode of it. It was pretty cool. We loved it. And then I was like, Quantum Leap. So I think that Bunny needs quantum computers.
Now, of course he does. He's got to process all those orders.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
At the same time, right?
That's right. Yeah. And I was actually very interested in that topic as of like, just something to like read about and dream about and just following it, and then thought, well, that's actually then a very good opportunity to dig a little bit deeper and figure out what's going on there. And I found some of cool things that's happening. Google actually have a Qubit game that's really cool. It's The URL is like quantumai.google. If you go there, there's a qubit game, and you got these qubits that you need to protect from the errors, from the heat that's happening around them. And then you also need to start collecting the information in one qubit, which is kind of shows you that the qubit is different to a normal bit. And then you got like a more qubits, and that then you can see how the complexity grows. So that's really, I don't know, I found it so cool. At the same time, I was like, ah, how the bloody hell you can have more than one thing, like, you know, more than zero one and state. One in more than one state. So yeah, and there was a link, and that's another thing that I found. There is a website called Quantum Atlas. It's like quantumatlas.umd.edu, which like really I thought have this short articles but with a very good illustrations, and then yeah, there you can also read about superposition and like how one thing is actually a wave and it's like many things, and now one thing can be in many places at the same time. I still can't get my head around the concept. It's like, and at the same time when I was reading it, I was remembering that's exactly what happened when I was starting to learn negative numbers in school. Because I was like, yeah, you can have one apple and two apples, and you can have zero apples, of course, just no apples. How can you have minus one apple? That doesn't make any sense. And this is like pretty much exactly the same. I was like, how like one thing and it can be like multiple places? And yeah, so that's literally still I read and I believe, but I kind of, it's very hard to imagine.
Yeah, well, that quantum atlas that you talked about there demonstrates the double slit experiment, right? And that shows you that yes, a particle, a photon, can be in two places at once. So it goes right back to that experiment, which was, you know, conducted 100 or more years ago. The reason why that is,
yeah,
and so we were talking about quantum computing and sort of latest and what's going on with it. I think early on in GCP Live, I think the first episode we talked about quantum computing as and what's happening in that, but there hasn't been a lot of evolution in the quantum field like since then. I think the biggest thing that I've heard about recently is using classical computers to reduce like forward error correct effectively the noise that you get in the quantum bits, because that's the big problem at the moment. And you know, they were able to reduce the error rate by sort of percentages based on what they had previously. So we've still got a long way to go.
Yeah. And that's what I like to do, to see, you know, where the thing is. You can go to Reddit and just go to like the subject subreddit and have a look at the posts like 10 years ago and now. And yeah, I compared 9 years old post with pretty much post from 2 weeks ago about, well, in the subject, just like, can someone explain to me what quantum computing is? And like you just read comments, right? And then you can get kind of the sense of where the things are. And yeah, as you said, practically it's, there wasn't too much movement from what it looks like, though that the thread from 2 weeks ago, the number of papers and number of research, and like that there is much more interest, I guess, in the subject from research and academic point of view. So I guess that should drive also the practical application, though. Yeah, and the other thing that I thought, well, of course, I need to have a look if Google is hiring for anything quantum related. And yeah, there is 21 jobs. One of it was just software engineer, quantum error correction, quantum AI in Los Angeles. And the minimum qualification is not as bad. You just bachelor degree, 2 years of experience with software development, 2 years of experience with data structures and algorithms. So if you really want to get into it, so you can.
The opportunities are there. Yeah.
There is a quantum fabrication hardware engineer, quantum AI. So yeah, so it looks like, yeah, sometimes I think, well, it's like probably like very cool to, you know, it's like a building spaceships and yeah, the quantum AI and all this black matter. So I was like, oh, like people are living a life.
Yeah, no, this is real. I mean, I think, I mean, what are the two big ones? There's a couple of big ones around at the moment. There's fusion, right, for an energy generation, and there's quantum computing. I actually think in our lifetime, I think we're going to crack quantum computing. I honestly do. I think that's the one that's going to pan out. Although they've made a few advances in fusion recently as well. Probably 5-6 years ago, I would have said hydrogen or electric cars. But I mean, it's pretty obvious now that electric cars are, we're on the tipping point now. They're going to take over. So that one's done. We've ticked that one off. But I think quantum computing is going to be the next one.
Okay. Oh, that's a good prediction. We can, yeah. We
can put that in the prediction show.
Yes, yeah. We can check on it next year, yeah, or 2 years, yeah, yeah. How long do you think? Let's finalize that prediction.
Five to 10 years.
5 to 10. Okay, cool.
it's always 5 to 10. All right, that's enough of the Easter Bunny. Let's get on with the news items. All right, and first news item off the rank is Alistair Dice, head of Google Cloud Australia, has quit.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there's nothing more to say about that. He's just quit.
Yeah. But all of a sudden, right? Like there was not many signs, I think. So that's yeah, that's
no, that's what seems odd about it. Yeah, it just kind of happens suddenly.
Yeah.
And what's kind of irking everyone over it is that Google staff in Australia were just kind of ghosted and left without knowing what was going on or what was going to happen with their promotion, the end of year promotion round.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, that's very, I thought, uncharacteristical for Google. But, yeah, and that's not good. And you would think that, well, probably, yeah. Do you think that Alistair Dice was personally linked to the promotions? Not really, right? They're usually like a system or something in place.
There should be a process in place. The only thing that I can think of is that he's left suddenly for some other reason. Could be an internal thing, could be an external thing. And that's just left a hole in the process where he would normally be sort of, you know, a pathway for that process, and that can no longer function without that head of Google Cloud in there. Whether they thought of that or not, or whether it's caught them off guard, I don't know.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. But there, we'll see. Now we'll see who will be next.
We'll see. But look, the article here does talk about potential, you know, funding cutbacks for Australia and what could be happening. It's still uncertain what could be happening with Google Cloud in Australia. To quote the article, they say, while Microsoft is great at marketing to its existing client base, Google tries to sell on its capabilities, right? Which is what we always say, right? That there's great engineering and great capability and, you know, and then the article goes on to say, in short, its competitors are selling sizzle, and Google offers warmed up cow, right? So, look, I agree with that sentiment. I don't know if I would have written it like that, but I agree with the sentiment, right? Google's not as flashy and as a whiz bang and as like hyped up as some of the other, as AWS or Azure, but what they sell is solid and reliable and well engineered, right? They won't go out and go to market with something that's half-baked or something that has like a high level of overlap with some other product, or it just confuses things, right? If you've ever used AWS dashboard, then it's just, I call it a shotgun. It looks like a shotgun's hit it. There's just stuff all over the place. And it's, what product do I use for what? It's even more overwhelming than Google Cloud.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with you. And yeah, I was always saying that marketing, yeah, is not the strongest side of Google, which is good and bad, because yesterday I read on LinkedIn, one of the CTOs kind of, well, I don't know if it was CTO or something, but yeah, so this the story was that one of the CTOs that picked GCP versus other clouds said that, well, the if you look at the Google, let's say even architecture center, you will see lots of time they will actually pick the best solution, which won't even involve like a Google product. It could be like some of the open source products. So sometimes it could be just third parties, right? Whereas like if you look at the documentation of other clouds, they would always, no matter what, just try to get like their products in. So in any reference architecture, so anyway, it will be just full set of their products, which is not sometimes the best solution for the problem that the paper is solving. And I think it's true. That's yeah, and that's probably, yeah, goes back to the cow and sizzle and to marketing, right? The kind of, because, you want to sell the whole package and eliminate competitors. And that's what other clouds are doing.
I could go into a diatribe about the way they try to sell Google Cloud VMware engine to enterprises and the expectation that their enterprise is going to want to buy everything, right? But that's not the case, right? Like a lot of the time enterprises just want to pick up what they got on-prem and just move it into the cloud, and they want to have as close as possible like for like.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And like, I was one of my friends, we were having a pint, and he's a software engineer as well. He was like, how cool would it be to just like write a cloud OS? I was like, what's cloud OS? And she's like, it's all this, like, you know, just the syscalls, like an open, read, write, close, like a normal operating system, but it would operate with the clouds. And depending on where you run and like what are you doing, it will just pick the cheapest cloud, right? So you can you create a file, and this file could be on AWS, so it could be on GCS, so it could be backed by anything. And then you can pipe, like, you know, do a cat and from one file and pipe it into another. It could create, like, I don't know, like a pub-sub topic or something. And then so it's like the whole OS will just work on the cloud primitives. But the idea is that it won't be attached to one cloud. It would be like provide the unified interfaces, and the implementation would be just using different clouds. So I kind of think that's kind of the future.
It's like a shim. It's like a shim that goes between your IAC and whatever cloud.
Well, yes. And like, and if you have like a standard, like you said, IPG, and if you have like a open API, right, and then you have different implementation of this API gateway that just implements open API spec. So then it shouldn't really matter on like on what cloud where you run it. Yeah.
A fantastic idea, Jimmy. Yeah. Great idea. You heard it here first.
Yes.
All right. That's enough of Mr. Alistair Dice. Let's move on. couple of new Google Cloud features, and I really like this first one. Cloud Run volume mounts. You can now mount a volume from within your Cloud Run.
Yeah, that's a fantastic news. I think before you could also use like a GCS fuse to like mount the bucket, but now this is like this is a legal way of doing it, when you can just add volume and
supported way, Dimmy.
That's right. So, it shouldn't necessarily be only a GCS, but it also can be NFS, which is like a cloud file store that you can use. And from that article, I really love the examples that they're giving. Like it's app configuration. We all used it. Like, I always use Secret Manager for that all the time. You just put all your config in Secret Manager and pull it from there. So where it's like, it wasn't really a secret, right? But it was the easiest way.
easy way to store it. You can just pull it out of there. Yeah, easy.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, when you run a Cloud Run or something. And then, event-driven, which is really good. So you can use Event Arc and trigger your Cloud Run application on events from the bucket, but now you can also mount that bucket and like get all the information that you needed straight away. So you don't need to use API like a gCloud API. And this is actually to the previous Cloud OS. So now you can just, you know, use normal files once you mounted it. So it's really not dependent on the API, which is also make it much easier to use during the local development. You can, if you run Docker, you can just mount that volume of your operating system and just use it rather than go to the GCS or Firestore using APIs. Yeah, so that's I think that's a very good thing. It's like, yeah, as I said, like reducing friction when you're developing locally versus you're deploying, kind of unifying it as well, and make it easy and very powerful feature, I think, to have. Yeah, that's great.
So having a file system directly mounted at the Unix level within the container certainly opens it up for a lot more flexibility.
Yeah, 100%. So yeah. And then I guess it's to finish it off, it's for Cloud Run generation 2. So it's like a new generation of Cloud Run. If you're not using it yet, then that's probably one more
one more upgrade to do.
Yeah,
definitely. I've got some websites that will definitely benefit from this. I think I can run them in there because the examples they're giving there is with Nginx and static files. Perfect use case, right?
Yeah, 100%.
All right, then moving on, we have expanded sensitivity data protect to make it easier, and it's been expanded to support Cloud SQL. Now, I never knew about this, Dimmy, so you're going to have to fill me in on what this is all about.
Yeah, sure. That's another great feature, and it's kind of adding up to the data governance and how you do it, and it's especially very useful for the big companies, I think, that have like many different data sources and like that have lots of data all over the place. And then what you can do is there is a discovery service that you set up, and it's just starting collecting some of the information about all your data sets. And that discovery service, it's only supported BigQuery and BigLake before. So it would just pull in like meta information about the data that you have. And if there are like any credit cards or first name, last name, date of birth, you could see it in this kind of one dashboard that would say, well, in your data sets, you have that much sensitive information. So now the Cloud SQL is there as well. So it will also, if you add the project, like a Google GCP project into that discovery service, it can now also understand Cloud SQL and pull that information from your Cloud SQL instances as well, which is, well, yeah, you know, I think we talked a lot about the data breaches and stuff. So this is what actually helps you to protect from those. So you can always have a look where you have sensitive information. You can always check if you need that sensitive information in those data stores, and if you need to remediate anything or put anything in place, or even if volume of sensitive information changing over time that you store.
Right. So it's PII kind of sensitive information. So I assume it's using DLP, data loss prevention under the hood, perhaps?
Yes. Yeah. I think, similar algorithm to figure out what's in there. Yeah. So one of the screenshots, would show your data footprint. It would say that you have like email, like 48% of your sensitive data is email addresses, and like 10% is credit card numbers, and like 5% is a person name. And you can also see that breakdown of what personal information you're dealing with. I think it's like very good. I think always on the show I have one horror story. So yeah, one of the horror stories, I was working like on a big client, like a very big client, everyone knows it. And they were like, oh, well, we just need a, we want to, like, you know, kind of modernize how we manage like a data projects in our Google Cloud. And then we, during the discovery, found out that people would just copy production data into the non-prod projects and just running their, like, you know, BigQuery queries on that production data. And it would be like all over the shop. And, you know, and that, those data would have folds, like first step, last step, date of birth, and like some stuff that you really need to be careful about, like addresses and all that stuff. And like, and there was like, you know, more than 100 GCP projects where like people would, and you could just, you know, you could casually create a project and like write message to someone and ask, can you please put like some data from production from this table to my project because I need to run some code on it, do some testing on it.
That, no obfuscation or nothing.
Nah.
Wow.
Nah. Yeah. So I think the tools like that, if you have them, because it's part of your security fabric. So it's something that you can, when you do your landing zone, you can come in and you can put the, it's part, the security fabric is part of your landing zone. And like, obviously, if someone copies the production data to the production, your footprint of sensitive data will just go up, and you will notice it straight away. Even if,
and these are non-prod projects, so you would assume that none of the security or permission, you know, usualness that you put in for prod would be there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Even if not going into the IEM and that everything non-prod and prod should be segregated and stuff. Yeah, so that's one of the things that I think, yeah, very good for like security teams to put during their foundation, to kind of lay it down there and say, it's there. It's not, it doesn't really need lots of management and stuff. So it's, it's good. Good.
Wow. You scare me every time, Dimmy. All right. Well, on that bombshell, let's move on. Introducing GKE autopilot mode, getting burstable workloads and smaller pod sizes.
Yeah,
we like a bit of GKE. This is good news.
Yes, Steve, and your bunny would love it. Yeah,
so well, he would love this. Yeah, because most of the year it's going to be really small, and then it's going to burst, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, yeah. So So that's another GKE upgrade, and Google just keep improving it. Sometimes you think, it's best in class managed Kubernetes. What else can you put in there? But here you go. So burstable workloads. That's probably very good for like startups and when you're just starting up with GKE. That's pretty much when you put like your resourcing. So you got your limit and you got your the required CPU and memory, and so then there is a delta between it, and then the workload can jump and burst up to the limit if needed, which I think is great.
Bursting allows your pod to temporarily utilize resources outside of those resources that it requests and is billed for.
Requests, that's right.
This is for autopilot.
Yeah, and autopilot is a great product, I think, because you don't have that high, like a steep learning curve for autopilot, but you have all the flexibility of Kubernetes that you need. So now that's awesome.
Without the headache.
Yeah.
Now on top of that, they're introducing 50M CPU pods, which is a pod that is 1/20th of a vCPU. So up until now, you could only get 250M CPUs. Now you can get CPUs 1/5 of that size.
Yeah.
And the increment now is more flexible as well. Mm. You can resize anywhere. So you can create any size pod you like between the minimum and the maximum size. 59, 302, 808, 7682, so on.
Mm, yeah. And then, so then there is a, so now you can pretty much, if you run a workload that's using 50M CPU, it will just cost you $2 a month. If you run it in US Central One, which is which is really, really cheap, right? I mean, before
and you get one free if you want to have a cluster on your account, you get one free.
Yeah, one zonal free. Yeah, free cluster. Yeah, because I remember when GKE just like Kubernetes at GKE just started off, and then it was quite expensive, right? Like to play with it or to just have your,
because they were big nodes. Yeah, big 16 gig, 32 core nodes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other example that I really like is that, so now you can run GKE with the load balancer and fully kind of like everything that you need to run, let's say, like web application or application on Kubernetes exposed to the clients, you could fit it all in $30 a month, which is, which is great. Yeah, I think that's a very good, reasonable price. And, it's much easier now to just, run it. And we should definitely leverage it for our mental centipede projects.
Yes. So it's easier with autopilot and it's cheaper now as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great for startups. Mm. I'm going to have a play with that. I've got 3 or 4 websites. I probably should migrate them to a cluster, I think. Yeah. Maybe for free. Yeah. Yeah.
Idea.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, moving on. Another cool new piece of news. Google to lay submarine cable between Chile and Australia. Now, there are no submarine cables between Chile and Australia currently, right? This is just the vast void of nothing. There's never been any need to do this previously. But here we are. We're not going to the US. We're not going to Europe. We're going between two Southern Hemisphere countries. I mean, this is actually a big deal. It's never happened before.
Yes. And it's again, our Easter Bunny can travel faster between Australia and Chile now.
Of course, when I say two Southern Hemisphere countries, I actually mean three, because it's going via Auckland as well. So New Zealand will benefit.
Lucky them
as well. So tech giants Google plan to link Chile with Australia and French Polynesia through the Humboldt cable, which would become the first direct submarine link between South America and Oceania, thus expanding the digital infrastructure of the Southern Pacific. This is great. I mean, there's a lot of South Americans in Australia. There seems to be, a high population. In recent years, there's more and more South Americans. Doing video calls to South America, you've got to go through a few hops. It must be sort of latent and problematic. This is going to really improve that experience for them.
Yeah, spot on. I think that's a great initiative. I also love it because it looks like it's like one of the things that, the Chilean government is kind of involved, and it would create like a 740,000 new jobs by 2027, which I always like those big infrastructure projects, because they kind of improving quality of life making lots of good things, and then at the same time they're creating your jobs and support your economy. So that's amazing news.
Yeah. Plus for them, I guess it gives them a bit more path diversity as well. They've now got two ways into Asia, into Japan and China. They can go up through the US or then come back around through Sydney and Australia. And I guess it's an alternate path for us into the US as well, although there are so many cables from Australia to the US, it doesn't really matter. But it's good to have that diversity there.
Yeah, I agree. That's definitely a good news. Mm.
And just as a side bit, the Humboldt cable is named after Alexander von Humboldt, a German scholar, geographer, naturalist, and explorer who traveled extensively in the Americas in the early 19th century. The name was chosen through social media voting by Chilean residents.
Ah.
There you go.
That's nice.
Very nice. Mm. All right, let's get on with a couple of security news items. We've got a real big security news item to finish the show off with, but just to kick things off, we have spyware vendors behind 75% of 0 days targeting Google. Now, I read this and I went, spyware vendors? What's going on here? Well, when we dig into this article, you're probably going to learn something that I didn't know. These spyware vendors are providing 75% of zero-day targeting. Google observed 97 zero-day vulnerabilities exploited in the wild last year, a steep increase from 2022 with 62 vulnerabilities exploited, but not as high as 2021, which saw 106 vulnerabilities. What's going, you know, this is interesting, Dimmy. What's going on here, do you think?
I think in the last year, maybe the last 5 years, there's like lots of news and controversy around governments trying to get to the phones and if needed. That's what's created that niche. So once it kind of got around, probably many people who knows thing or two about security, they thought, oh, maybe then we can just discover those vulnerabilities and sell them, right? Including governments.
Exactly. And this is what this report goes into. One of the more notable points of the report, and this is a bit I didn't know, involved commercial surveillance vendors, CSVs, which are companies that sell spyware to entities such as governments, with well-known examples of these including NSO Group, Intellexa, and CipherGate. Although Google put the spotlight on commercial spyware vendors in another Google Tag report last month, then this has just highlighted the extra context. Now, this is what I didn't know this existed. So these people sell these 0 days to entities such as governments, so they can spy on their citizens? Mm. I mean, this is some dystopian stuff right here.
Yeah, that's really, I don't know, 1984, right?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So it goes on, the article goes on, according to the report, 75% of all known zero-day exploits targeted Google products. 75% of all known targeted Google products and the Android ecosystem. 55% of all iOS and Safari 0 days came from CSVs. Meanwhile, of the 37 zero-day flaws Google tracked affecting browsers and mobile devices, over 60% were attributed to spyware vendors. So what's going on here? Are these spyware vendors, have they got a sweatshop themselves where they've got, you know, engineers and hackers working out these 0 days, or are they buying these 0 days off unscrupulous individuals in China and Russia? What do you think is going on?
I don't know. Yeah, my guess. I can just speculate, but I have a feeling that I don't think that they're buying. I think they might just employ people, as you said, from Russia and from China, and just
could be anywhere in the world, but I'm not casting dispersions, but there's a high possibility that's where they come
that's
from.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Being Russian, you know. But yeah, and then yeah, my thoughts would be they would just discover them once, and then they just sell them legally to governments. Well, legally in quotes. And then yeah, there's also like the black market where you can go and always buy a 0 day, which are like very expensive. Mm-hmm. So like if someone is buying them, they probably have a very good plan of how they want to use them and how to make some profit out of this investment.
Yeah, well, these CSVs, they've got a business to run, right? They're looking at their return on investment. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, the 0 day might be very expensive, but it might be a good 0 day. The article does talk about the value of 0 days, and this is not something I'd thought about either. If it affects the broader the zero day effects, the more value it has. So if a zero day was found in Chrome and it was at a very low level in Chrome and all versions of Chrome were affected, that would have an extremely high value, right? Whereas if it was just some little weird esoteric problem that only affected one particular distribution of Linux, which is the kind of thing we'll get onto, but it's a bit bigger than that, it may not be worth so much, right? Or some little weird thing in iOS, in, you know, well, iOS is pretty big, but, you know, if it affected both iOS and Android, then it would be worth more than if it just affected iOS.
Yeah.
If you catch my drift, yeah.
Mm. No, yeah, that's my market value, yeah.
Market value, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a little, I'm not going to say, well, I was going to say little cottage industry, but it's not a little cottage industry. You can bet they're paying big dollars for these things. The whole industry is built up around producing zero days and selling zero day flaws in software.
Yeah, yeah. And like, if you look at the numbers, yeah, it was like, it's a 100 something zero days. So there's not that many, to be honest. Like, I mean, you would always wonder, is it like a known zero days, right? I mean, do they have like, you know, those companies, they might have just like a pipeline of those zero days and they can, you know, and someone will come and ask, oh, can I have zero day for Android? And they will, oh, here you go. And then they will like, you know, sell it, let's say, I don't know, to 10 people, right? But then they might have like another 20 of new zero days that are just in the back pocket. And they're like, oh, okay, so that, yeah, they found this one, so let's start selling another one. So, and yeah.
Well, it'd be like diamonds, right? You can't release, there's more than enough diamonds for everyone, but you can't release them all at once because it just devalues it, right?
Yeah.
So they'd have to hang on to them for a certain amount of time and then they sell them. But they've got to be careful that they don't hang on too long because someone else might find it and then it just loses all its value.
Yeah.
Right. You've got to drip feed them out at the right rate.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, all right. So while we're on the subject of zero days, let's talk about the big security news. We're going to finish the show off on this one because this is a monster. Secret backdoor found in the Xe Utils library impacts major Linux distros. I mean, this could have been, I mean, we dodged a bullet here with this one. This could have been a real big deal. So to sum it up, just before we get into sort of our discussion on it, a Postgres developer, it was Postgres, wasn't it? Yeah, a Microsoft Postgres developer noticed a problem with SSH. I mean, he's not even a security guy. He's not a reverse engineer. He's a database developer. But he noticed a problem with SSH on his machine. It was using more CPU and taking longer than normal to log in. And he must have had a pre-release version. He did have a pre-release version of Debian, the new version of Debian. I assume he was getting his packages ready for the next release of Debian. And he noticed this problem and he went and started investigating it. And then he found all these problems and posted up that he discovered a backdoor in SSH that was caused by this Xe util.
Hmm. Being a big Debian fan, I can just say that it made it to Debian unstable and then to Debian testing, but didn't make it to Debian stable, which is like, which was a relief. Well, at least for me personally, as a Debian fan.
But here's the thing: it was not in the Linux, the Debian package itself. It was in the source code of xzlib. Right, so if any other any other distribution had have used that source code to build their package, they would have encountered it as well. Now, Arch Linux, and I can hear the Arch fans from the high hills now, it didn't affect them, right?
Yeah, and to add to that, it wasn't even in the source code of those exe, it was in the source code of tests. Like, I mean, yeah, so it's...
Yeah, so let's get into that. How did they get it into the open source code?
Yeah. I got one of these, kind of timelines, the full timeline of the whole thing. Mm. And it's just incredible. The whole thing started in like 2022. So September 2022. So it was like almost like 2 years ago. So it's been very much planned. And I'm actually... I would never think to what length people went. So yeah, one of the person called Jiatan, they basically started just contributing small fixes to that XZ dev library, which is basically the library that helps you to compress and uncompress files, and it's used in a lots of different tools, including SSH, and I believe Linux kernel does use it as well. So that person just started putting a small fixes in, and then just starting appearing here and there on the mailing list. And then he was doing it more and more.
No other previous activity from this individual.
Yeah.
Right? That's what, now looking back at it, what is odd. Yeah. Right?
But then there was also a strategy. So he would create those changes and pull requests. And it's all going through the mailing list in the, like, you know, old fashioned way, no pull request, but it's like a patch just sending through the mailing list. So that whole library, it's been maintained and supported by one person, Lassie Collin. And so he was dealing with all the development, with all the support and with everything. And so there were like another people appearing on that mailing list, and they were just pressuring him to get changes into the changes merged pretty much.
That's right. Because historically the release timelines for this particular patch is very slow, right? There's not much change happening on it, but there was some pressure to speed things up and get it going.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And again, as you mentioned before, that was from like emails that no one could find any previous activity of. So they were all just fabricated emails. And like to add up to that, like that Lassie, he was saying in one of the emails that like he was dealing with some mental health issues and others, so he doesn't really have time to look after it properly. And so then there was like more of those pressure emails. And then at the end, like Lassie just made the Jiatan a kind of maintainer. And that's when... Because also I think that maintainer means that that the person that all this, as you said, Linux distributions, they trust those maintainers. So he started adding that Jiatan onto those maintainers list as well, which means that like the trust was growing among the whole community to the Jiatan. And even then, like, I mean, that the changes that were done, they were like, I mean, I don't think that like, I'm being a dev, I couldn't still fully understand all the changes and what's been done. So very good job, I guess, into the hiding those changes, because they also, as I said, they were not in the main source code of the library. They were in the test files that were used during the build. So yeah, then when different distributions like Debian, they will build the package or supply the sources to build from sources, then that's what would trigger the backdoor injection, which is very clever.
So there was a whole chain in order for it to happen. I'm going to try and paraphrase it here from what I remember reading and watching. There was a script that needed to be run, and that script would inject a precompiled object code into the GCC compilation that had to happen, right? Now, you couldn't just put that script in there into your makefile, because everyone's going to see that script run. Now, here's the tricky bit that had to obfuscate that script, right? So in order to do that, That script was firstly encrypted, ironically, using the XZUtil, right? And then once that was unencrypted, it just came back as a binary blob. And that binary blob, if you were just to look straight at it, it was nonsensical. But once you unencrypted it, you got another thing which gave you a series of head commands that could be run. And those head commands, if you know, they're just Linux head commands, would extract 1,024 bytes, or they would throw that away, then extract the next 2,048 bytes, save that, extract the next 1,024, throw that away, then get the next 2,048, and it would link all these binary, all these binary blobs together. Once that was all done, then it would show you the script. So it was like a two-layer obfuscation that happened to hide this script that would then execute under certain conditions and then inject this object code into there.
And even though, what is more interesting, Linux has this landlock support, and it's actually should have prevented even building that. But then what I'm just reading from here is that the J10 breaks landlock detection in ConfigureScript by adding a subtle typo in the C program used to check for landlock support. The ConfigureScript tries to build and run the C program to check for landlock support, but since the C program has a syntax error, it will never build and run, and the script will always decide there is no landlock support. And so that configuration step would just pass, and that would be it. So that is that's a really rocket. And then,
Just error it out, right? Why not?
So
there's two parts to this, right? So you get your code into your library, right? Now, they apparently did that quite successfully. What does this thing actually do? Well, what it turns out it does is it had a public key which belonged to the hacker. It embedded a public key which belonged to the hacker. And if the hacker comes along with his own private key, then it would basically trigger and give that individual root access to the box and allow that individual to send remote root access commands. But the way it sends those root access commands is very, very tricky. You can't just send them across the wire because you would have detected that. It sends them encrypted in the TLS handshake of the connection. So if you know anything about encrypted connection, there's a point at the start of the connection where certificates are exchanged. It was embedded, the commands are embedded in that certificate exchange. Normally you wouldn't even look at that. Normally you'd bypass that if you're in your interrogation, but no, they were able to embed that in there and you could execute remote commands.
Yeah, that's the whole thing is just incredible.
Really sophisticated, isn't it?
Yeah, and but at the same time, I'm very pleased of how quick that was detected, and that's we started with that open source community, one person who maintains libraries that bloody used by everything, when they try to distribute this new version, it's been picked up very quickly by others who are thankfully reading the changes and patches and what they're putting into the Linux distro. So yeah, that's I think it's you can feel the power of the open source as well here. Yeah.
But what's going to be the wash up? That's the thing. How is this going to change people's minds, and what's going to change as a result of this? That's going to be the interesting thing to see.
Yeah. I'm honestly hoping that we're just, I'm hoping that companies that are using open source, they will just, and Google probably would be one of the greatest examples how they support open source community, how they release their own open source, creating open source communities. That's just another example where maybe they shouldn't be someone asking money, let's have a look if this project worth it, and maybe we give them a bite, but maybe there should be something in place to not wait for asking for money, but just look at what we are using and like just going and making sure that those projects have a, you know, they just running healthy. They have support from a big companies. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Rather than sort of what's happened in this case where an overworked, overstressed maintainer was pressured to hand over the maintainership to some unknown rando individual, and this is the case. This is the outcome, right? So if that project had support from some other third party, then this may not have happened, right? This could be a way to avoid it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think that's hope that will go further, and
So when the listeners hear this show, it'll be in about a week. So there may be some follow up on that by then, but we'll certainly in the fortnight show after that catch up on where we're at with things. But it is a very, very sophisticated, very interesting exploit, and I think there's going to be some pretty serious wash up around it as well.
Yep. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. You read it. You read it like a. Detective story, you know.
It's a detective story. Like, look, I'll link some stuff in the show notes. Go watch a couple of videos on YouTube, because there's some security analysts that break it down really well, better than we can do. But on that, I think we might leave that there. Hey Dimmy, it's been a great show today.
Yes, thanks Steve. Yeah, been good. Great chatting to you.
It's been always fun, mate. Always fun. Look, don't forget, go to iTunes, write the show review. It'll really help the show out. You can also go to our YouTube channel now. That's probably our main sort of contact point. You can start a discussion there on the YouTube comments. You can also contact the show, gcplife@kasdan.com.au. As far as I'm aware, that's not being changed to a Mantle Group one for the moment. And don't forget, today's sponsor is Mantle Group. At Mantle Group, we make your Google Cloud solutions possible. Well, we're going to end up with a little bit of an extra long break here, Dimmy, because we've got the show recorded now, and for us, it'll be about 3 weeks before we record the next one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, awesome.
Awesome. Have fun on your trip, and take lots of photos, and I really want to hear about it when you get back.
Yes, yeah, I will. Yeah.
All right, we'll catch you later. Bye. How's your internet?
Well, yeah, that's great news. It's been fixed. So
right.
Yeah.
What have they done to fix it?
Well, they changed that bloody box underground. Just ripped it and put a new one.
Aha! Now, is that box just for your property or for the whole building?
No, for the whole 10 units. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And like, yeah, so three other units, mine and three other units, didn't have internet either. But we have like quite a few elderly people that probably don't use internet at all. So
never noticed. Yeah.
Yeah.